Our next speaker is Paul Gottfried, chairman of the history department at Rockford College. He is resigning in June to assume command as a senior editor of the Washington Times. Of course, we wish him well in that new task, which is living in Washington is a challenge no matter what you're doing. He is editor of Continuity, the historical journal. He's the author of The Search for Historical Meaning, and there are some brochures, incidentally, out in connection with that in the lobby. He's the author to be with Thomas Fleming of The American Right, to be published tonight. When will that be? So look for it as we go out there. He has a wide range of scholarship, as all these gentlemen do, on conservatism and how it relates to history. Dr. Gottfried.
I intend to be contentious in my remarks, and perhaps even more contentious than I am by nature. I hope I give no offense. But I would like to present what I consider to be substantial differences between the conservative and neoconservative camps, and perhaps speak again as somebody who has contributed to a meaningful discussion, what I hope becomes a meaningful discussion between the two sides. Might and power, as Machiavelli reminded us, do shape human affairs. Both are also relevant to the theme about to be discussed, the rise of neoconservatism as a force on the American right. Those identified as neoconservatives enjoy demonstrable respect in conservative circles. Conservative foundations fund their enterprises generously, in some cases almost exclusively. Conservative think tanks court neoconservative celebrities. National Review solicits their contributions. American Spectator and Policy Review feature them with predictable regularity, and the neoconservative publications, commentary, and public interest are often described as the preferred journals of conservative intellectuals. Peter Steinfeld's The Neoconservatives, Whatever Its Defects, and more recently Gillian Peel's Revival and Reaction detail the signs of favor that the American right has bestowed on the neoconservatives. The hostility to Southerners and many traditionalists, indeed people to their right, that surface in their publications usually fails to catch the attention of their conservative admirers. Even traditionalists like to believe that neoconservatives have come a long way, or that in any case they're still growing. Such assertions need to be reexamined. Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who contributes to neoconservative journals and used to be on the masthead of public interest, was an anti-Soviet, pro-Israeli liberal Democrat in the 1960s, and he remains one today. Carl Gershman, Sidney Hook, S.M. Lipset, Daniel Bell, all of whom appear frequently in neoconservative periodicals, have been self-labeled social democrats most of their lives. The same is true for Jean Kirkpatrick, however savagely she may denounce communist tyranny. Norman Poteritz, Nathan Glazer, Walter Burns have usually characterized themselves as Truman Democrats. The neoconservatives' relationship to the welfare state puts their political allegiances into context. They support the economic redistribution and social reforms of the New Deal Democratic Party, up to the point at which that party succumbed to what the neoconservatives call contemptuously the McGovernites. Although George McGovern and the late Hubert Humphrey had almost identical senatorial voting records in the early and mid-70s, commentary praises Humphrey while excoriating McGovern. The difference is largely symbolic. Humphrey, like Truman, is a neoconservative synecdoche for the old left center. McGovern represents a radicalized Democratic Party, which is weak on Israel, soft on the Soviets, and which the neoconservatives abandoned with fanfare in 1972 and again in 1980. Despite their leftist point of departure, neoconservatives sometimes adopt conservative-sounding rhetoric as part of their mission to the right. Michael Novak, for example, calls Pope John Paul II a neoconservative, quote, a person of the left who has learned to be critical of the left. In order to fight liberationist and progressive theologians, according to Novak, John Paul has taken the most effective stance possible, quote, the Pope is not a traditionalist, neither is he a progressive, he's a neoconservative, unquote. Is it permissible to ask whether God, too, is a neoconservative? Irving Kristol has been even more diligent in distinguishing neoconservatism from the left. Kristol has described the death of socialism as the process whereby the conservative welfare state has proved itself the best means of combining social responsibility and market incentive. George Will has found a venerable pedigree for the welfare state, which he traces through Disraeli, Bismarck, and Burke all the way back to Aristotle. Most of this rhetoric is mere packaging, as its users must well know. I believe that Will and Crystal are too intelligent to think that they have found precedents for a modern managerial state in either Bismarck's attempt to preserve a military monarchy by creating social pensions for German workers, or in Disraeli's search for a popular base for a stratified English society and monarchy. Discovering pre-modern antecedents for a postmodern welfare state requires a fideistic leap of faith. Without such faith, it is hard to believe that those bureaucrats who impose minority quotas or who bungle our social security are in point of fact a counter-revolutionary vanguard. Neoconservatives usually follow Ben Wattenberg in viewing history as the bad old times. The closest they come to evoking a past golden age is in depicting student life at City College of New York around 1935. Neoconservatives reminisce about interpreting Marx in the alcoves of the college cafeteria that turned out to be way stations on the road to commentary. For most neoconservatives, the happy days are in the present, which they seek to preserve with only minor alterations. This was the point of a series of TV lectures by Ben Wattenberg a few years back. It is also the theme of a recently published book of his, which ascribes high divorce rates and other apparent signs of social decay to newly won freedoms. In the November 1985 issue of Commentary, other neoconservatives provide even more exhilarating pictures of contemporary American life in a 40-year perspective. Peter Oberger, for example, extols, quote, the gigantic political efforts to ensure that no group within America is excluded from the cornucopia of industrial capitalism. He marvels at how racial discrimination was abolished in a few years. Looking toward the future for even further progress, Berger calls, quote, for a specifically American version of the welfare state, unquote, without the bureaucratic obstacles that has accompanied similar projects in Europe. The neoconservative literary critic Joseph Epstein sums up his own sense of progress thus. The southern part of the U.S. has seen and shaken off its medieval torpor, and if you happen to be black, cruelty. In a speech published last summer in Encounter, Podoritz expressed wonder that progressive intellectuals criticize America even though its democratic institutions are perfecting themselves. A French hero of the neoconservatives, Jean-François Revel, makes the same point even more emphatically in Comment les démocraties finissent, how democracies perish. According to Revel, the communist threats to the West has come precisely at a time when Western democracy is internally the most secure. Revel poo-poos Tocqueville's warnings about an overreaching state developing in a democratic culture. Quite the opposite, Revel says, has happened in America, where a socially responsible but non-intrusive regime coexists with diversity of opinion. Neoconservatives are not always right as Pollyanna optimists, but they do so often enough to make me wonder about their reputation as social critics. Looking at the November 1985 issue of Commentary, one could distinguish the neoconservative contributors from the more conservative ones by the emphasis on social progress. Most neoconservatives interpret the last 40 years as a slightly rocky march toward the New Jerusalem. The conservative contributors do not. This presentist view of Western society is intimately related to the neoconservatives' advocacy of a global democratic revolution. Whether one reads Berger or Michael Ledeen in Commentary or the statements of the National Endowment for Democracy, which blend neoconservative shibboleths in the interest of organized labor, there are constant themes associated with the revolution desired. It is to lead to a worldwide, secular, politically egalitarian society with a mixed economy. In the short run, non-Western governments are to be encouraged to hold democratic elections and to undertake land reform, unionization, and capital formation. The entire world, that is to say, is to be reconstructed as a mirror copy of the present-day America celebrated by neoconservative publicists. Understandably, those who scorn this vision of progress or who glorify the past have not enjoyed the neoconservatives' esteem. Susan Garment, writing in the Wall Street Journal on October 13, 1985, notes how National Review had to struggle to overcome its beginnings. I quote, today's American conservatism does indeed have part of its roots in a seedbed infested with racism, chauvinism, and paranoid looniness. When National Review was founded in the mid-1950s, the right's presence on the U.S. political stage was small and fading. Conservatism seemed fatally tied to this pernicious kookiness. From time to time in National Review, you can still hear an echo of the right's distasteful origins. The sound fades as time passes, because over the years, Mr. Buckley and his associates with National Review as a rallying point pried conservatism from the fingers of its demented followers. This battle against paranoid looniness was apparently still raging in the late 70s when Norman Podoritz and his friends declared for Pat Moynihan the New York senatorial race. In Breaking Ranks, Bodorus depicts himself as supporting the moderate progressive Moynihan against the left-wing extremist Bella Abzug and equally extremist incumbent Senator Jim Buckley. Bodorus here was striking a characteristically neoconservative pose as the moderate wedged in between the right and the left. Diane Ravitch, whose writings and educational problems appear often in neoconservative publications, has claimed to occupy the same middle ground. Writing for American Educator in fall 1982, Ms. Ravitch addresses the urgent matter of saving public education from the new rightist danger. It is not clear that there is much difference between the old right and the new right. The old right concentrated on political issues and spied communists behind every idea or book they didn't like. The new right concentrates on moral issues and blames secular humanists for undermining the morals of children. Both yearn for ideological and moral purity. There is, in fact, a ruse concealed in this attack on the old and new rights. Whereas Ravitch castigates the right for being insensitive to professional education, she weighs in against the left for its far-out ideologies of sexual liberation. It is worthy of note that Miss Ravitch feels obliged to sound like Norman Lear before she allows herself to make the useful point that sex education programs harm the young. She also decries the creationist progressive educators and sex educationists as adversaries of American learning. But as Miss Ravitch surely knows, not all these groups have aimed at or produced equally far-reaching changes. Creationists have not brought about our deteriorating SAT scores, nor the breakdown of discipline in classes. They have done nothing to encourage sexual promiscuity or contempt for established social institutions. The religious right has not even been effective in keeping evolution out of our high schools or in putting the deity back into them. Ms. Ravitch's argument shows rigid dependence on a stylistic paradigm which the neoconservatives are unwilling to forsake. It puts them at the vital center of a political spectrum, flanked by crazies on both sides. My own sense of things is that the neoconservative stress on the middle ground is largely formalistic. Their hearts, in most cases, are with the left, even though their expense accounts come from the right. I make this statement as a qualified generalization, in full awareness that one can find genuinely conservative sentiments in the writings of Irving Kristol, Midge Decker, and other self-described neoconservatives. Indeed, neoconservatives have been tireless in denouncing the Soviet danger, and I think probably much more so than the old right, and in warning against the menace of international terrorism. Yet these facts by themselves do not negate the view that the neoconservatives are a breakaway. Offer this analysis and trace the origins of neoconservatism to quarrels among American liberals that were exacerbated by ethnic tensions. Particularly critical, according to Steinfeld, was the rift in New York during the early 70s between black civil rights leaders and Jewish educators and other Jewish and indeed mostly white municipal employees. The neoconservatives' disagreement with the intellectual left has been characterized by painful disappointment. In reading Contentions and Analysis of News Commentary, edited by Midge Decker, I am struck by the fact that the contributors spend so much time minutely refuting liberal columnists from New York newspapers. Surely not all the opinion being criticized is apt to have impact. Indeed, much of it hardly gets read beyond the Murray Hill and Greenwich Village districts of Manhattan. But this is the culture. These are the notables whom the neoconservatives take seriously. An intimate, though strained, relationship can be shown to exist between them. Indeed, I would argue neoconservatives seek to justify themselves in the eyes of their liberal opponents, such is not the case in their relationship with the right. It should be noted that conservatives, not neoconservatives, misrepresented the movement in question. Neoconservatives are being honest when they state that others started calling them conservative against their will. They have never made a secret of their fear and loathing of that part of the right which they cannot reshape or convert to their views. Why, then, do conservatives pursue them with favor? Certainly it is not because they are the only anti-communists around or the only people who express reservations about minority quotas. The truth of the matter is that conservatives are largely ignorant of their post-war history, so much so that they have embraced the neoconservative interpretation of it. The conservative movement, as seen by many conservatives themselves, had no brain power, or to use the operative term, academic prestige, before the neoconservatives arrived on the scene. I've heard pre-New Deal Republicans praise the neoconservatives for defending capitalism in difficult times. Since America is not likely to return to a pre-welfare state economy, so the argument goes, the neoconservatives have taken the realistic position that half a cup of capitalism is better than none at all. The neoconservatives are supposedly protecting that half a cup when they advocate an efficiently run welfare state that ultimately provides greater revenues for itself by granting tax reductions. This last defense of the neoconservatives is easily refuted. George Gilder has made the excellent point that neoconservatives are principled, not reluctant supporters of a welfare state and planned economy. Their view of government's role in economic matters differs fundamentally from that of their conservative benefactors, and it is foolish to believe that they would seriously work against the social development which, on balance, they applaud. The intellectual right, moreover, did not lack for gifted journalists and thinkers before the neoconservatives came along. Nor is there reason to assume that the American right will shrivel intellectually if the neoconservatives become reintegrated into the left. Have they produced more penetrating social thinkers than Richard Weaver, Robert Nisbet, James Burnham, all self-identified conservatives before the neoconservatives had their falling out with the left? Was Will Herberg, the religious editor of National Review, at a time when, according to Susan Garment and Joseph Epstein, the journal was still a rallying point for anti-Semitic cranks, any less of a sociologist of religion than Peter Berger? Does the New Criterion feature more perceptive aestheticians than Elie Saleh-Vivas, Russell Kirk, and George Panichis, all longtime editors of Modern Age? Are Emmy Bradford and Andrew Lytle, both Southern conservatives, and Peter Stanless less able literary critics than their neoconservative counterparts? Are the contributors to Modern Age less learned or less eloquent than those who write for commentary? In my own field history, I cannot think of a certified neoconservative other than Richard Pipes, who has left any scholarly mark. I exclude Gertrude Himmelfarb, a superb intellectual historian who was a traditional conservative, long before she became, I assume for family reasons, a neoconservative. I offer these comparisons not to disparage those who have benefited from the neoconservative ascendancy. I'm only challenging the tendentious view of the old right taken by the neoconservatives and those influenced by them. This view of an intellectually sterile, bigoted right redeemed by the neoconservatives is in fact related to a second historiographic myth, that the neoconservatives' current prominence was already apparent in the 1950s. The devotees of this myth assign excessive importance to journals of progressive but anti-Soviet opinion centered in Midtown Manhattan as molders of the post-war political environment. In The Liberal Mind in a Conservative Age, for example, Richard H. Pels, a famous historian of the left, discusses what may be styled incipient neoconservatism, although Pels puts into focus the growing gulf between Cold War liberals like Irving Kristol and forerunners of the new left like Philip Rav. He also unhappily produces a typically neoconservative interpretation of the 50s. His survey of its intellectual life, as John Lukacs has observed, really moves beyond two or three blocks in Midtown Manhattan. Pels identifies James Burnham with Partisan Review and Dissent, totally ignoring Burnham's more substantial contributions to National Review. He refers anachronistically from the perspective of the 50s to anti-communist liberals as conservatives. Pels shows no awareness of the critical difference between Sidney Hook and James Burnham, that is, between an anti-Soviet socialist and a key architect of the old right. His world of ideas is that of social democratic sectarianism, as it expressed itself among contributors to several New York-based journals, all with local readerships. The same perspective is seen in an essay by Todd Lindberg, an editor of Public Interest, published recently in Commentary. Lindberg writes with a certain bitter nostalgia of New York's decline as a center of learned opinion. The main evidence of this putative decline is that several neoconservative journals and journalists have moved from New York to Washington, thereby causing, from Lindbergh's standpoint, a veritable translatio imperii within the world of political commentary. Professor Shapiro emphasizes that neoconservatives draw from the social sciences and statistical research more heavily than do the older conservatives. This is undoubtedly true, as even a superficial comparison of Public Interest and Modern Age should make clear. Yet this generalization must be qualified. Most popular neoconservative journalists like Newhouse, Dechter, Kristol, Novak, and Podoritz present their views without fussing over statistics. Indeed, part of the appeal of neoconservative arguments among the business community is their avoidance of the highbrow. For example, Nathan Glazer opposes minority quotas as inconsistent with the 1964 Civil Rights Act and with the individualism that he associates with American democracy. The conservative humanistic perception of quotas is infinitely more complex. It is based on a view of unchanging human nature and on various authorities from Aristotle to sociobiology. Conservatives believe in the corporate nature of man and the intrinsic soundness of sexual roles. Defending these propositions requires more intellectual energy and makes greater demands on the listener than the neoconservative argument about whether quotas really produce equality and are consistent with 1960s-type liberalism. There are admittedly more neoconservatives and old conservatives at prestige universities. One reason for this that I myself have mentioned on other occasions is that conservatives ever since the 1960s have fled universities for political careers. This tendency, which Stephen Tonser has called the politicization of second-generation conservatism, has had definite consequences. It has caused movement conservatives to lose contact with the world of thought and ultimately forget their philosophic roots. Yet this tendency did not develop without external pressure. While at Yale, I heard conservative students discussing the ostracism of Wilmore Kendall, which I myself remembered. Indeed, I myself recall a productive scholar, Charles Moser, being denied tenure by the Department of Slavic Languages. Moser's colleagues made no secret of the fact that his anti-Soviet views had directly affected the tenure decisions. Neoconservatives who were then on the left were generally less subject to such professional setbacks. And though there are obvious exceptions like Walter Burns, many neoconservatives protected their left flank, even while they quarreled with the left by opposing the war in Vietnam. I suppose in view of the late hour, perhaps I should come rapidly to my conclusion. Many of these remarks may seem petulant and even spiteful, but perhaps are long overdue. A Marxist friend explained to me that all movements have their Trotskyist and survive only by periodically expelling them. Theologians tell us that religious communities can only endure by recognizing and condemning heresy. Yet the Marxist analogy may be more apt in the present circumstances. There's a close relationship between Trotskyism and certain neoconservative attitudes and values. Attention has been given to the background of Irving Kristol and other older neoconservatives as former members of a Marxist-Leninist group at war with Moscow. I believe this Trotskyist connection is of more than antiquarian interest. A Trotskyist mindset has surfaced in the neoconservative movement, as seen by its emphasis on global revolution and democratic universalism. For American radical intellectuals of the 20s and 30s, Leon Trotsky, who had been driven from Russia by Stalin, incarnated the idealism of the Bolshevik Revolution. Although Trotsky was a brutal killer who had supported the mass execution of, among others, Russian social democrats, he was a flamboyant Marxist intellectual. And he viewed the Russian upheaval in November 1917 as merely the first step in an imminent global socialist revolution. Abjuring all forms of nationalism, including Russian, Trotsky looked forward to a world society established through shared revolutionary ideals. An intellectual vanguard would lead mankind into the new age. It is not hard to recognize the link between this vision shared by the Marxist sectarians at City College of New York and the global democracy now preached by the younger neoconservatives. James Burnham may have been looking only at surfaces when in 73 he perceived the liberal gestalt behind neoconservative rhetoric. In my opinion, globalist revolutionary idealism is a common characteristic of both Trotskyists and neoconservatives. So too is the view that these groups have of themselves as occupying a middle ground between reactionaries and misguided revolutionaries who are derailing historical progress. This last point is crucial for understanding why neoconservatives' thinking combines presentism with what Theodore Draper has called a messianic and guilt-ridden treatment of history. Like the Trotskyists who offered qualified support for Soviet socialism, two cheers but not three, the neoconservatives defend the present American society in comparison to earlier or alternative ones, though not as the fulfillment of all their hopes. Such a fulfillment would only be possible in a world without Soviet communism and its threat to a global democratic welfare state order. Democratic model that account for the hand-wringing of neoconservative polemicists. Contrary to Draper's assertions, the neoconservatives do scold the right for insufficient enthusiasm about democracy as well as the pro-Soviet left. If neoconservatives fight the left more vehemently than they do the unconverted right, however, it is not because of their rightist orientation. Neoconservatives view the right as an unpleasant but useful base to be occupied in pursuing their love-hate struggle with old comrades. At stake in the struggle are related visions of progress and global revolution. One may observe among the neoconservatives a typically Trotskyist ardor for revolutionary purity. Michael Adine, writing in Commentary, deplores the fact that reactionary South Africa, as well as Soviet Russia, has thus far resisted democratic revolution. Democratic globalists are not interested in mere allies against a common totalitarian enemy. Like Revel, Ladine, and the National Endowment for Democracy, they seek ideological soulmates for a world crusade on behalf of democratic ideals. In responding to those of his readers who objected to his partial defense of Solzhenitsyn as a critic of the liberal West, Norman Podoritz proudly called himself an idolater of democracy. One might respond by reminding Podoritz and other neoconservatives that there is a biblical injunction against idolatry. One might also remind conservatives what Eric Fuglin said about the Gnostic glorification of the here and now. Such warnings may be useful as long as conservatives look to neoconservatives for self-validation. What the neoconservatives can really offer the intellectual right is not self-validation, but an example of self-respect. The right may desperately need that in both the long and short runs. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Paul. Be sure and let me know when you're going to go on the podium and really get hot, if you will, because I'd like to hear you. That was great. The